From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The grand old party is picking up the pieces after decisive losses in this month's election. Now Republicans are looking for new voices who could transform the party. Former Maryland Lieutenant Governor Michael Steele says he wants a shot at running the Republican National Committee. He now heads GOPAC, a powerful political action committee that helps guide Republican candidates for elected office. It's been reported that former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich is also vying for the RNC leadership and also once ran GOPAC. Michael Steele is back with us to talk about the future of the GOP and his own future as well. I started out by asking him about vying against Newt Gingrich.
Well, I don't make the case that I'm better than Newt Gingrich. I don't make the case that I'm better than anyone. Well, first off, Newt's decided not to run for the job, and he's in fact supporting me in my efforts. Newt is an idea guy. He is the professor. He is the thinker. He is the one who crystallizes emotion and policy and opportunity all into a package that helps the party begin to speak clarity on some of these complex issues. And I'm very happy to have him help me do that. And the way I'm looking at this race for chairman is I'm not running against anybody for this job. I'm running for the party. I'm running to present a set of ideas that I think are relevant to how we change and how we grow and how we become a part of this new landscape that Barack Obama has created.
Let me unpack the Newt Gingrich thing a little bit.
Sure.
When did Newt Gingrich throw his support behind you?
Well, he and I chatted last week, and we haven't rolled out a formal announcement. I guess I really kind of scooped that here, but we haven't rolled out a formal announcement. We're working through, how we want to do what we need to do in terms of the next 6 weeks of this campaign for the chairmanship. But Newt has gotten to see me run GOPAC. He's seen me in terms of working more broadly with the base, but even more so with a diverse group of voters out there. And I think he kind of likes my style. You know, it's kind of I'm not taking any crap from you style, and whether you're a GOPer or anyone else, and kind of laying up, this is what we've got to do to be successful. This is what the party's got to do. I think he likes that. So I've been very, very honored to work with him and have his help in sort of talking about and identifying some of these strategies that I think will be very important for us to go forward.
So you wanted to be RNC chairman 4 years ago, and why do you want the job now?
Well, I think, I watched after the 2006 election, a party that was demoralized and really rudderless, not really sure of itself. Its message was crumbling, if not crumbled at that point. The party faithful lost confidence in the leadership, and then we moved into 2008, and it got worse. and I'm sitting there thinking to myself, okay, am I a part of something that's supposed to be energetic and forward thinking, or am I a part of the last dying gasp of the RNC and the GOP? And I didn't want to be the latter, so I wanted to work hard and try to turn this ship around. I believe in a competitive two-party system or a multi-party system, for that matter, in which ideas are tested and tried in the body politic, and the people have a chance to make up their own minds. And with the election of a Democrat administration controlled by Democrats of both the House and the Senate, the party can't afford to step down and step back. It has to reengage. It has to reignite the ideas that were of importance to it during the last 15 or so years, and speak truth to power, speak honestly to the people, and let the folks stand clearly one way or the other, but let them have something to stand on. And so that's what pushed me to get back into this race.
How can your party speak truth to power while there are so many ideological divisions within your party? And what I mean by that is that you have fiscal conservatives who, we had someone on from the Log Cabin Republicans who was talking mm-hmm. about the need to overturn the passage of Proposition 8, which, mm-hmm. Which basically says that gay marriage is outlawed in California. And you have people like Arnold Schwarzenegger and the mayor of San Diego, people who have opposed gay marriage in the past who now support it. So you have people who are Republicans who are not social conservatives at all. You have
right.
people who are social conservatives, like Governor Palin, who are not particularly interested in having a intellectual agenda that goes with that, that are very populist. And then there's you. You are a social conservative, but also very interested in fiscal issues. And you are also an intellectual and someone who has a deep faith background as well.
Yeah.
How do you see yourself operating within the framework of all these different trains of and strains of thought in the Republican Party?
Well, I'll be taking a lot of Maalox and a lot of Excedrin. You
know? But who are your allies?
You just so really eloquently summed up the post-Reagan Republican Party. And I would submit to you that those fractures and fissures exist, and if they not completely, they will come to fruition at some point, even within the Democratic Party, when you look at their reach out to social conservatives within the Democratic Party with the election of individuals like Mark Warner and Tim Kaine, Heath Shuler, who are, you know, pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, pro-business, socially conservative value voter types, and how that gets reconciled with an agenda that's less focused on the social aspects of issues as opposed to the economic and so forth. That's the same dilemma we have. That, you know, Democrats don't have to worry about it right now because they're winning, and that's good. The same was true with the Republicans. We didn't have to worry about that when we were winning with Reagan. When we won in the 1990s, the House and the Senate. And then, of course, with Bush in this century. So all of a sudden, you stop winning. And you have to ask yourself, why did we stop winning? Well, we stopped winning because we lost resonance with the people of America. We lost our voice, to use a Clintonian phrase. And we have to find a way to get it back. And part of getting it back is going to be addressing the log cabins, the pro-choicers, the pro-lifers, the pro-Second Amendment folks within the party, and recognizing fundamentally that despite the differences that we may have on some or all of these issues, there is a common thread that unites us that causes us to self-identify as Republican. Now, if you self-identify as Republican because of the pro-life issue only, then you're going to have a problem in a party that is multifaceted and complex, in that you have pro-choice Republicans as well as pro-life Republicans. So the dimension that we need to get into and recognize is that the party has changed. This is not your mama and your daddy's Republican Party anymore. I call my brand of Republicanism Lincoln Republicanism because it focused on the rights of individuals. And when we speak about the rights of individuals to make those choices, whether it's, you know, for this, that, or the other thing, that's empowering. And that's what's so important for us, I think, to get back to focusing on is how do we empower communities to do for themselves, to lift themselves up out of poverty, to lift themselves up out of poor education, to create these opportunities that are focused first and foremost on their own interest as a community and as individuals. And all that other stuff takes care of itself. I'm very pro-life, but I'm not going to beat up a pro-choice Republican and say, well, you can't be in the party because you're not pro-life, because that's defeatist. That's not recognizing that this individual is also a reflection of America and communities that we want to be competitive in and speak to. So you're right, it's going to be a challenge, but it's something we're going to have to confront with ourselves. You'll see this played out, I'm sure, over the next few months in this race for chairman. But it's a dynamic that we can't escape because Reagan isn't here to heal that wound anymore. Reagan isn't here to focus, help us focus on other things. We have to now be self-directed and self-focused about the core principles and values of the conservative party, which we are.
Let me jump in for a second. What sure. is the role of the Republican National Committee?
That's a good question.
Okay.
Why is it
a good question?
Well, because the role has become, I think, disjointed and really skewed. It has become this national behemoth that sort of dictates from on high how we run and win elections. And the track record over the last two cycles, at least, has been abysmal at best. We can win, so we thought, national elections. But now we've come to realize we're not even good at that anymore. And so the strategy for us is, as I see the RNC in this century, is decentralized. It is focused on helping state and local parties energize the base, develop strategies and messages for communities, identify candidates that can run on those messages in those communities, and support them. Create this network, this vast network, using people power, internet power, communication power to help rebrand this party. So it's less, in my view, it's less about, oh, gee, we're the be-all and the end-all, and more about we are part of the solutions that state and local parties put in place to help win elections state and locally. Because then we'll work our way up to winning these federal elections and all this stuff that we like to do nationally. It's got the ground game has got to be a little bit closer to home, which is what I want to see us do. And certainly after this, if I win this chairmanship, trust me, you and I will be, you'll be sick of me, because I'll be spending a lot of time talking with you and running ideas by your audience and really trying to, you know, get honest feedback on stuff that we're doing.
Well, Michael, thank you.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Michael Steele is currently the chairman of GOPAC. That's a Republican Political Action Committee. He recently threw his name into the running for chairman of the Republican National Committee. We asked former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich for comment, and he said through a representative that, quote, Newt Gingrich is not endorsing Michael Steele. Steele is one of several people that Newt likes who is running. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Somali pirates snagged their largest offshore prize to date, a Saudi oil tanker. On land, Somali Islamic militants strengthen their grip in key cities, and fighting continues in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That's all on today's Africa Update with Amira Wood. She's co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. How are you?
I'm well on this snowy D.C. day.
Oh, my goodness. Wow, I had no idea. Well, let's talk about pirates. It's one of those things that you would think are out of the history books, but Somali raiders started taking over commercial vessels. And this week they took over a Saudi supertanker loaded with crude oil worth at least $100 million. This ship is three times the size of an aircraft carrier, and the pirates tend not to take the cargo, but they hold it and the crew hostage and ask for ransom. They pulled in millions of dollars. So why do you think that, you know, this piracy has rekindled in Somalia, and what does it say that they were able to take over a ship of this size with this kind of cargo?
Well, the critical thing here, Farai, is that the Somali economy is essentially in shambles. People don't have access to jobs that can pay a meaningful wage. And so what you have in the midst of this, again, lawlessness because of the crisis in Somalia over a lack of a government, you have now people trying to find whatever means they can to survive. So this is actually one of, according to Al Jazeera, 63 ships that have been captured this year alone. And I think it is a sign that the desperation is intensifying and more people are looking to a much less legal means, let's say, Farai, to try to make a living.
Well, the U.S. Navy is calling for these ships to arm themselves for protection. Let's listen to Commander Jane Campbell talking to CNN.
Perhaps the only measure that could have protected this vessel is if it had had an embarked security team. We have been making recommendations since the problem began to escalate to have the merchant mariners take increasingly proactive action.
It sounds like open warfare on the high seas, you know, very much, again, something that is almost out of a book. What kind of rules apply to a situation like this? Is it kind of, you know, anything goes?
Well, Farai, this is the irony here. It's almost as if the Bush administration has militarized, again, in a foreign policy that puts the military first. It's almost like every nail is a hammer. So you have seen the steady militarization of this area with U.S. Navy operations very active, really, for the last 2 years now throughout these waterways. But it hasn't made a difference. Again, you have to go to the root causes of the crisis. The root cause is the lack of a government and the lack of a viable economy there. there in Somalia, once you're able to create a space where people can make a living, have a decent wage, be able to put food on the table for their children, there will be less of a tendency towards this type of illicit activity. So instead of further escalating the crisis, we need to look at really addressing the root causes to be able to create a more livable and peaceful Somalia.
Now, inland, Islamist insurgents have been taking over towns in Somalia. They took over the key port city of Mirka without firing a shot. These Islamists control a large and expanding region of south central Somalia. They're imposing Sharia or fundamentalist Islamic law. We're going to talk more about the impact of that religious law in a few minutes. But could these rebels take over Mogadishu, the capital?
Well, we have had now over these last few months a steady movement further of what is, in the eyes of many Somalis, a much more legitimate governing force than the one that's currently in place. Remember, it was December 2006 when the U.S. actually ousted the Union of Islamic Courts in Somalia. The Union of Islamic Courts had brought for a six-month period when they ruled the first ever period of peace since 1992 for Somalia. So you had this six-month window where people could send their children to school, women could walk in the streets freely, and there was a sense that life could begin again. Yet because they had Islamic in their name, the Bush administration decided, no, that was unacceptable, and went forward and working with Ethiopian ground troops and U.S. airstrikes and also U.S. naval operations actually ousted that government. What you have had since is an incursion of these now insurgents that have been organizing, steadily organizing and gaining strength throughout the country. And they are now right at the doorstep of Mogadishu, according to many reports. So it is very likely that this clamoring for a sense of determining their own future will lead to a more outright victory there in Somalia, and that you will have this current government that's been sort of propped up by Ethiopia and the United States in short order losing its legitimacy.
All right. We have a couple more things to touch on. Not a lot of time, but a horrible story again in Somalia. A young rape victim, some people say as young as 13, some people say as old as 23, but certainly a young girl or woman was publicly stoned to death for adultery in a very brutal situation after she said that she was raped by three men. Do you think that there is any will to try to stop incidents like this? And that policy, though certainly not, I think, universal, was related to an interpretation of religious law. Who's going to stop it?
Well, I think we have to be clear. There are women living under Muslim law that are, some are facing extraordinary challenges, and many others are, in spite of living under Muslim law, are taking leadership in a number of areas. You see human rights defenders all the way from Western Sahara to Somalia, where women peace activists in Somalia have been clamoring for peace and justice in the country, not just for women, but for all Somalis. So I think we because again of the difficult situation, we have to remember that Somalia is 90% Muslim, not extremist Muslim, but 90% Muslim. And we have to understand that there has to be a space to not hear Islam and not hear Muslim and hear extremists. So,
okay.
So clearly there's a lot of opportunity to work with Somali women who are taking forward advances in women's rights, advances in women's political processes, even as we speak, Farai.
Amira, we really have just, you know, a tiny bit of time. What should we keep our eyes on in the Congo? Micro.
Well, we got to keep our eyes on the resources, the flow of resources from the Congo, the coltan that creates our cell phones and our computers. That is the root of the fighting in the Congo. And until we can have a Congo where the resources serve the interests of the people, we will continue to have crises like we do today.
Amira, thank you.
Thank you.
Amira Woods is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. She joined us from her headquarters in Washington, D.C. The inspirational sounds of the Soweto Gospel Choir are unmistakable. The 26-member ensemble hails from the churches and communities of the Soweto Township in South Africa. The choir blends tribal African gospel music with traditional Western gospel sounds. The gospel choir is currently on a 49-city North American tour. I'm pleased to be joined by two choir members, Sipokazi Luzipo, she's the show's narrator and lead singer, and the choir master and choreographer, Shimi Giane. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
So tell me a little bit, and I will start with you, Sipokazi. Tell me a little bit about the choir's history, and I understand you've got a lot of people who are on the younger end of the age spectrum, so how'd you come together?
In 2002, our Australian producers came to South Africa to watch a show called Umoja, which was a dance show, and they were so impressed with the dance that they felt a need to form a choir that would take the South African sound of gospel around the world. So auditions were held in Yeovil, downtown Johannesburg, and there were long queues. I'm telling you, some of the best voices in South Africa. And everybody that is in the choir made it through the auditioning process.
What was it like for you? Do you remember your audition?
I do. It was a bit nerve-wracking because I had just graduated from high school, but I didn't have money to further my studies. And I was actually hoping that an opportunity like this would come. And so when the producer called me and told me about the auditions, I was a bit nervous because there were some of the great singers of gospel in South Africa that were there at the auditions. I sang my song. The producers were very happy with me. They called me the next day, told me I'd made it into the choir. And since then, life has changed dramatically.
In what way?
Well, touring the world. Yeah. I had never been on a plane before. So being on the plane for the first time and it being overseas was just the best. When they said we're going to Australia, I was so excited. And when they said to me we'd perform at the Sydney Opera House, and they said Pavarotti's performed there and Michael Jackson, and I thought, my God, you know, I'm just new in the industry and I get such opportunities. And so definitely professionally and financially, I mean, this is now a stable job.
Shimi, what was your first memory of a performance that really changed how you thought about what your life was going to be like?
It was in 2001 when we performed in Sydney Opera House, and where nobody knew us, nobody knew who was Soweto Gospel Choir. It was our first concert. And after the show, we just got this huge standing ovation and this huge applause, and everybody was loving what we were doing. I was like, wow, I've never seen this before. So that's when I started saying, then good things are coming.
You have so many different types of music on this new CD of yours. One of them is your interpretation of the spiritual River Jordan. Sipokazi, what does that song mean to you?
It means a lot, because what happens with us as a choir is that we're so young, so we tend to like to challenge different types of music. Yes, we sing South African traditional gospel, but then some of the international spirituals as well do touch our lives. And so I've grown up with a single mother, and I'm telling you, she used to play that disc all the time. I remember going to sleep with that song, By the Rivers of Babylon. And so when the producer said that the choir was going to sing the song and give it our interpretation, man, I was excited. And I think that's what I love about us as a choir, is that we take some of the songs that the audiences know, but we give them our feel. We give them the Soweto Gospel Choir feel, and it always works.
When you think about this 49-city tour, Shimi, what do you want to deliver on stage? Because given that you're the choreographer, there's got to be more than just singing. There's got to be movement. So what are you trying to transmit?
wherever we go, each and every city that we go to, we try by all means to showcase our cultures, our different cultures and faiths in our country, and our 11 official languages. In our show, we sing in 6 of those. So we try and showcase those kind of things. And then with the choreography, we do a couple of choreographies with from the Zulu tribe, we do a Pedi tribe, we do a Tswana tribe, and the Xhosa tribe. So we try and showcase those. These are people, they can see what is South Africa all about, especially when it comes to gospel.
And what about the charity that you guys run?
That's our little baby, called Nkosi's Haven Vukani. Yes. It's an organization that supports other organizations in South Africa that either receive little or no government funding. So every day after the show, we collect donations, and those donations go to those organizations. We put on our jeans and our t-shirts, and we go to their homes, and we either buy the kids blankets, we buy them fridges, we buy them food, we buy them medicine, be it books, be it blankets. And we feel that that's our way of giving back to our community, that as international and as famous as we've become, that we can share our prosperity with the little ones back home, especially the AIDS orphans.
All in all, when you think about what you've done, I'll ask you first, Shimmy, what would you say is your mission in doing this work?
Our mission is to keep on ministering to the people and keep on making people happy, making people change people's lives, and to make sure that everybody gets to know what's happening in our country.
Sibakazi?
I definitely think it would be to showcase the beauty that South Africa has. You know, we are not only singers, but we feel that we've become ambassadors for our country. That after everything that South Africa has been through, Soweto Gospel Choir is one of those products where you look at and you think, wow, we weren't aware that such beautiful things can come out of that country. And at the same time, not only sing and dance, but minister to people's souls. You know, when people come to our show, they come with different situations. Some are down, some are just broken. Some just need that one song or that one dance or that one smile that can change their lives. So for us, it's like we are soul doctors, you know, we deal with the soul. When I go up there and I sing, or when I go up there and I dance, it's not only about my shine, it's about changing someone's life through that song that I'm singing. And so our music has got so much passion and so much beauty in it, and it's not only about us, it's about people seeing the beauty that is in our country through our dance, through our talent, through our music in South Africa.
Well, I want to thank you both so much. I look forward to hearing from the other members of the choir, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very much.
We were just speaking with Sipokazi Luzipo and Shimmy Gianni, members of the Soweto Gospel Choir. They were both at member station KUVO in Denver, Colorado. Their U.S. tour continues through the end of December, and you can catch a special performance live at the Nelson Mandela Theater on a new concert CD and DVD.
One song.
Just one song. Yeah.
Yes, it's a Zulu song called Noyana, which means, will you go to heaven? Siguyo windlela.